This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is Shauna Morgan, author of Fear of Dogs and Other Animals. And here she is with an opening poem.
Growing and weeding. I've always lived in the midst of things that grew faster than I. My mother's white roses, our coolie plum tree, my cousin Charmaine, whose breasts appeared overnight and sent me to the bathroom, pressing my arms against my chest. I tried to grow things too. A young chicken fallen from the Caribbean broiler's truck, my sister's cherry tree, thyme in the Virginia winter, a jade plant from the Baxter brothers, who were not brothers at all, a white dendrobium that flowered once. When I wondered why things tended to die, he said it was me, that I killed everything green, especially money. But today I remembered how I grew things, how I cared for African violets, never letting water touch the velvet leaves, how the purple flowers would burst and burst. I birthed children, two at once, and grew them in a garden of heirloom tomatoes and yellow gladioli. Today, I will plant raspberry bushes for summer, and soon dahlias, giant sunflowers, and moonshine yarrow for the vase in our kitchen. The children and I will harvest black crim and zucchini, pick gungu peas, and cut ripe honeydew from our new vines, weeding as we go.
That is the voice of Shauna Morgan, and she teaches creative writing at Howard University in Washington, and her current research focuses on representations of Black womanhood in 21st century literature, something we will want to find out about. And Shauna, I'm holding this book, Fear of Dogs and Other Animals, and how do you describe it?
This is a collection that deals with the journey of healing, of resistance and overcoming, focuses on women's stories, primarily children, mothering, and the legacy of strength that we often need to overcome difficult situations.
And there is much about injustice in this book.
Yes.
What is the hardest thing about writing about injustice? Is it the feelings you have to write it, or how to put it down? What is the struggle?
The struggle, you know, involves a lot of things. It's also navigating those deep emotions that can overtake you at times, sort of harvesting all of the things that are causing a whirlwind inside of you. If you've had a deeply personal experience or connection that is linked to injustice, and also there's a tremendous responsibility to render something artful that also speaks to the experiences of people, personal or sort of more communal.
Shauna Morgan is a scholar as well as a poet. And she comes from Jamaica and has a love for the diaspora and teaches the diaspora, I believe, at Howard. And in fact, you teach a course on the African diaspora. What is that?
I do poetry and fiction, most recently fiction across cultures, which focuses on different aspects of the diaspora. So I do Afro-Caribbean literature, Black British, African-American South, and also some West African literature, Afro-European literature.
Well, what does diaspora actually mean?
Right. So diaspora refers to Africans not on the continent. So those who were taken in bondage or even new immigrants are also a part of the diaspora.
I see. Lots of people think it's a geographic surround, but it's not. It is cultural.
Cultural,
isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Here she is with another poem.
Resume names. We gave them resume names. I had a different list and lingered on every letter, enunciating and singing each syllable, whispering at first, shouting them, laughing them out, feeling the way they vibrated on my tongue and blew from my lips. Then I read each meaning, searched for a root, something free, anchored only by legacy and heritage, Black and brown names scented by bisop and masala, flavors to anoint tiny feet and wrinkled heads of dark hair, bundles wrapped in batik and kanga, mouths rooting at my breasts. I wanted names as dark as my areola and the insides of my mother's thighs, strong as an umbilical tug, sharp as the contractions that drew them out, determined as my will, more unyielding even than his last word.
Let's have another. I think we're getting to know you.
This one is Perpetual Winter. And I wrote this after an experience with my daughters a few winters ago. They were having a snowball fight outside, and lots of neighborhood children, and someone called the police during the snowball fight. Rowdy, but they're kids, just playing. And it was alarming to me. Perpetual winter.
Mm.
Even as we march towards spring, there is no letting up. Children are playing outside, clomping their feet, looking to step where it is safe. Their laughter invites others, and a snowball fight ensues. Hand grenades of winter sail between trees, some reaching their targets, exploding into squeals. Lights flash across my face, forcing their way past our curtains. No one sees the patrol car until black boots reach the pavement and hot yellow streams run and mark the snow at her feet.
Mm.
Lips now trembling, she looks towards home. Does not know she must not run. I never told her not to. On the insides of my arms, blue thumbprint bruises still hold me long afterwards. The sky, another uniform above us, a final lesson on dirt and flowers and snow.
That is so powerful because there's nothing worse than sullied snow.
Yes.
Once it gets muddied, once it gets ruined, once that innocence is tampered with, that is such an evocative poem. Do people like that and respond to it?
Yes, particularly now.
Of course, but the fact when adults have such stories and you have a story about your brother that comes home with marks, and he was doing a perfectly respectable job, and yet when it's a child, then your blood does run cold.
Yes.
So that is a really important poem. That should be shown many places. And you are published in many literary reviews. You won the Catherine James Palmer Prize. Was that for an article interviewing the Caribbean?
This Interviewing the Caribbean is a journal, a contemporary journal of Caribbean writing art.
And you also were a finalist for the Small Axe Literary Prize.
Yes.
And you've been published in A Gathering Together, Proud Flesh, New African Journal of Culture, Politics and Consciousness. I should read them all. The Journal of Afro-Latian Arts and Culture, Illuminations, many, many, many. And critical work, which is important too. What is interesting to me is you got a PhD, right?
Yes.
On post-colonial and African-American literature and theory from Georgia State University. And now you're getting another PhD?
Yes.
What is wrong with you? In American studies? Tell us about this. In Germany, I am really blown away.
Yes.
I mean, I am a PhD dropout. And that you made it through the hoops of fire once, and you're going back. So what is the deal with Germany?
When I was actually finishing, after I had completed my comprehensive exams for the first PhD, I got an exchange fellowship to Johannes Gutenberg Universität in Mainz, right on the Rhine River. It's very beautiful. And they have a very well-developed, very successful American studies program. And I went to study and teach for a year, and they asked if I would like to continue studying there. And so I decided to focus on race and American poetry, something that they were particularly interested in. And so It is in English. I learned German, but the dissertation is in American studies, so it will be in English.
And your PhD will be called what?
It's Neo-Anticolonial Poetry. Contemporary neo-anti-colonial poetry, and so I'm advancing this idea of 21st century African-American, or actually Black diasporan poetry, as neo-anti-colonial.
Are there other books on this theme? I know there are books on colonialism and anti-colonialism, and I know Claudia Rankine has done collections which touch on that, but this sounds very much a niche, is it?
It is. Neo-anti-colonialism is a term that was used in the late 60s once by a very caustic critic of anti-colonialists.
Oh, really?
And he used it in a pejorative way, and so I've sort of claimed the term now, and I'm thinking about what anti-colonialism looks like in the 21st century and artists engaging with that.
Wow.
Specifically,
this
poets.
This is a vindication.
Indeed.
It is. How long will this take?
Well, I should be defending next year.
So you'll go through orals and you'll have a book?
Yes, I will.
I am just amazed at the energy. And you have twin daughters.
I have.
And you teach full time.
I do.
And your scholarship is ever ongoing. And you're writing poetry and teaching poetry.
It's an interesting dance.
It is. You're quite the balance act. Well, you're ours today, and we love it a lot. So let's hear another poem. Are you going back to the book?
I am going back to the book. In fact, since we were talking about Germany, I'm going to read one of the poems that I wrote while I was living there. This one is called Der Pfau, which means the peacock. And this one was really inspired by my children at the time. They became fluent much sooner than I did.
They went with you?
Yes, yes. And they were in a German school. And so there was a lot of sort of helping mom to understand the language as I was learning German myself. And while I was there, one of my uncles in Jamaica passed away, and I was very close to him. And the experience of loss is, as I thought about it then, in much way was sort of the experience of being in a foreign space in Germany, in this place where it's, you know, so many things are incomprehensible. And so learning this new space of mourning for me was like being a foreigner. And so this poem came out of that. Der Pfau. We hurried past the flower shop on Portlandstrasse. There was still light, and I clutched their little fingers, meine Zwillinge. Mama, gestorben means died. All that time she had been chasing her peacocks and scooting around the backyard under nesberry trees with him, trying to render loss into locution. Gestorben means died? I did not know. Ich verstehe nicht. I do not understand gestorben. And I do not want this plane to cross this dark sea, to land on that soil, because then it will be real. Mm-hmm. I do not want to feel the sharp gravel on my bare feet, to see the wet grass flashing blue-green where the proudest bird has left his feathers. I do not want this burden, to collect the plumes for the vase near his desk, to lament the years away, the time not spent, the silences. I do not want to know this word, gestorben.
You know, when I read that, I was extremely moved and touched by it. It is so weighted with authentic feeling. And yet I did not know the context. I did not know there was a real death. And I did not know, I actually took it as an abstraction. And yet it was powerfully moving. So now I know what it came from. And the children were with you, and they went to school every day, and you went to school every day. And what kind of dwelling did you have?
We lived in an apartment. So it was a house with three apartments, and the woman on the bottom was the owner, and she had a lovely garden that we shared. And so the girls and I would leave every morning and take the bus to the university. Their kindergarten was actually on the university property.
Will you go back?
Yes, and I have gone back. I was
to that
there.
Place, though, to live there?
No. Mm-hmm. When we do go back, we stay sometimes with friends and sometimes rent other places.
Because you've built
places.
Up a network.
Yes.
And tell us about the Obama Institute there.
Yes, the American Institute, the American Studies Program, it's sort of in the same vein as the Kennedy Institute in Berlin. And so they wanted to, because the American Studies program there is really looks at not just the continental U.S.-American experience, but how America has shaped the world. They launched this program because Obama sort of represented this kind of American leader who had so many sort of global connections. And it's really focused on every aspect of
what
American studies.
What a place to be. What a place for you to develop. What a place for you to be a scholar. But that's you're wonderful. Our poet. And so we'll go forward with more poetry. And we're still on the book, Fear of Dogs and Other Animals.
Yes.
And is that available?
This is available. You can find it directly from the press. Central Square Press is a small independent press in Boston.
So they can Google that.
Yes.
Make sure you do. Yes. Central Square Press.
Sawdust. The lumber stretches long and hard, pocked like your legs, a home for sores round and brown, a center crust of yellow, a community of imperfections. I inhale. It is your smell without you, without your sweat and the metallic odor on top of wood, without flecks of sawdust in your silver at night hair. I inhale you, a sanitized, pre-treated, uncut, unbolted, unhinged you, your smell in the morning, 6 o'clock punch, sawdust shavings under your feet, Coleman in your hand, ice-cold Bickel in this land for me, triangle trusses on your back for me, a chip off the old block, mm-hmm. or rather curled and curled shavings, delicate but unfeminine. You are just like your father. Mm-hmm. Heavy feet, bones marching, steel toes hammering the ground. And your smell, no longer mahogany, pine, cypress. We went to buy plywood but got birch instead. The storm would have taken our roof and left the windows intact. We would have blown out like these shavings, golden fibers in a whirling cyclone, inhaled and lodged in the lungs. I inhale you.
I love it. I love that.
This poem is for my dad. My parents have a home in Jamaica, but now live in South Florida.
And oh,
my dad,
really?
Yes. And my dad has worked in construction for many, many years. And there are certain, you know, I could walk into a Home Depot, for example, and
smell. Feel your father.
And feel my dad and smell wood and feel his
Does
presence.
Does he like the poem?
I think so.
Well, you are a teacher as well as a poet. How do you begin a poem, and how would you tell your students to begin?
There might be some contradictions there. And I teach creative writing poetry. How do I begin a poem? Poems come to me every day. Often I see poetry in everything, you know, things my children
That's
do.
That's dangerous for a scholar.
It is.
It might get you off the rails.
It has gotten me off the rails. I've spent lots of time writing poetry when I should have been researching. but it's wonderful. It's a wonderful gift, I think, to
so
be able to
blocked.
See it.
So you're not blocked. You're just a channel. You're not blocked. You're not resisting. You're not afraid.
No, not at all. Mm. I don't always make the time to capture those things fully. I always make note of them and sometimes come back to them
Well, they're
later.
Well-polished,
oh,
so they
you.
Show hours in. And for your own students, what do you think you can do to help them?
What I have done and what I've told my new class of young poets is that they bring with them a creative authority from their various walks of life. You know, I try to sort of dismantle those large, you know, esoteric notions of who can write poetry. And so I help them to first be comfortable with welcoming their own authority, their own creative expression. And we start there. We start with them and then sort of throughout the semester challenge them to then sort of depart from that a little bit and explore different avenues to find a poem. I'll read the title poem from the collection. And this poem, well, I'll read it first. Fear of Dogs and Other Animals. My brother would tell me not to run from a vicious dog, not to show fear, but to greet his teeth with my own and even growl. I didn't know what he knew about dogs, except that he could handle a pit on a chain better than anyone, that he hated hounds and German shepherds and poodles and collies, which I called lassie dogs until I was very grown. My brother would tell me that white folks love their dogs more than they like us, that they would rather their dogs eat steak and sleep in beds and on plush sofas than see us make a way. I didn't know what he knew about white folks, except that he worked for a man named Gist, who had a big car and always had pictures with the mayor. Sometimes my brother would get stopped by the police after driving that man somewhere. And sometimes he would get pox in his cheeks from bits of asphalt and blacktop stains on the front of his pants. My brother would tell me to never walk home on Maple Street, but to go the long way down King and always with my friends. I didn't know what he knew about Maple, except that he said there were men, there were dogs and men who could tear into flesh, that canine teeth and hot bullets were never shy or hesitant, that white folks know dogs and guns like we know death and poverty. He knew, except he knew too well.
The voice of Shauna Morgan at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. You know, if you tell your students, it's about the stain on the pants. It's about the pit mark on the cheek. Those details just absolutely penetrate the mind and will not go away. Wow, Shauna Morgan. But this is a new book now. I see in front of me, but it's a mess. It's not even stapled together. It's a pile of papers.
Yes.
And what's going to be the title?
This collection will be called, and it has some Jamaican patois in it, actually. It's called God Flesh Bakra Cloth. And Bakra is a word that comes from a tree in Ghana. But in the diaspora, in the Caribbean and in the American South, South Carolina, it's Bakra. And it usually means the sort of white overseer.
Yes.
And so the title actually comes from something my grandmother used to say.
Read us something.
Sure. This poem is called Molasses, and it deals with the sort of legacy of enslavement and imperialism, but it also deals with people sort of surviving that and what they needed, what their ancestors or families gave them. It's called Molasses. Dem tell me said Burton did hard. Life torn from my mother who squatted in the dirt, her back against the trunk of a soursop tree, the one she often stole away to, drawing circles in the soft ground, calling up root weevils when her fingers were a plaid of sugar-caned skin and blood. It was there they found me, mounted on her left breast, suckling death, covered in sex and a vernix of ghosts, her hands still holding my back, navel string still ichan, tayopinar. Me mother never knew what the rainbow mean. She was buried there along with my most beautiful scars, the afterbirth always beckoning me home to witness the memories of old folk, their songs and stories marking my flesh, echoing something my bones find familiar, a chord that reverberates through my hips and thighs. Mm-hmm. She come down fast like fire in a kien piece, they say. Always turmoil in what they tell, and I can't be sure if they are speaking of my birth or what my mother endured, growing me between rows of cane, light brown child pressing against her molasses, a bitter confection made with indelicate hands. This poem, Black-Throated Songs, is a poem that deals with one of the things I really enjoy doing is seeing how nature reflects our lives, how much we can learn from nature. And this poem is about the black-throated blue warbler, which is a bird that lives in North America but travels to the Caribbean and sort of lives in two places, much like myself. The understory trembles, confessing the secret of her nest in woodbine, virgin ivy. She listens, flits her unremarkable self, offers up a moment. See, see, see! Shrill to a buzz, he perches higher, bill up. See, see, see! A melody skyward, cotton belly, black throat quivering, eminent plume turning blue as the mist burns away. See, 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 see! She vibrates her wings. everything else falls away. Under a deciduous canopy, hovering together in aftersongs, until the young are fledged, until the freedom of salt air, until the sanctuary of moist ginger lily, until the oak and maple come again. There, a white spot on a wing, below the viburnum berries bursting, a faithful warble of fruit.
The poet notices everything. The poet pays attention. The poet knows how to see. And a final poem.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This last poem comes from a collaboration that I started with another poet, started writing what started out as Middle Passage love poems, but then evolved this collection I'm doing with Frank X. Walker, who you know.
You mean he'll write one poem and you'll write another?
Yes, yes. So they started as Middle Passage love poems and sort of evolved to plantation love poems, and we're sort
of
working up.
How many do you have?
So far, I have about 35 or 40
poems. And how many does
poems,
he have?
Probably about the same. Scent of wood and water. Before breeding slaves became more profitable than buying them, she walked, feet bare and dusty after dark, through wood sorrel and wild sarsaparilla, her legs and knees sweetened by the berries. She tore off wintergreen leaves, crushed them in her fingers until she reached him, all scent and water. And he, salt-skinned, a journey on his back, valleys and rivers and ridges, reached for her in the dark, knowing just where to find her waist, how to free her breasts, how to love, all scent and wood and man, until she whimpered, rested on his shoulder, and greeted him with her tongue, and slept at last.
I love you, Shauna.
Thank you so much.
That is her voice, Shauna Morgan, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.